We're almost finished this big book of Zephaniah as we come to chapter 3. And, you know, it's just like your pastor. When he starts getting close to the end, he just seems to slow down, doesn't he? I don't know what it is about him. So we're in Zephaniah chapter 3, and I've got news for you. We're just going to be looking at verse 18. So we're slowing down. When you come to the end of these prophetic books, you begin to realize that all through the prophecy, God has been revealing the problems, the issues, the things that have to be taken care of and righted, so to speak. But by the time you come to the end of most of these, and I say most because some of them are directed towards the other nations, but when God is specifically dealing with his people and you come to the end of these books, you begin to realize that God ends with, but we're going to make you right and we're going to fix the problem. And you're just reading almost towards the end, complete restoration at the very end. And just whatever prophecy it is. So let me just kind of give you some examples of that. You look at the end of the book of Isaiah. Of course, Isaiah kind of starts off, to put it mildly, you're basically a dumb ox type thing. So, you know, it doesn't start off real complimentary to the people. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, he says, your whole head is sick. So we know that, you know, they're having some major problems. Of course, God says, you know, you go in the temple and you start praying to me, and you think that you continue to pray and I'm going to listen to you. I'm not going to listen to you. So throughout the book of Isaiah, you begin to see all of the terrible things that they're doing, and God begins to reveal these two things to them. But you come to the end of the book of Isaiah, and how many? Isaiah? I'm sorry, did I say Isaiah or did I say Jeremiah? Okay, Isaiah. Let's come to the end of Isaiah. We'll go to Jeremiah in just a minute. Because it basically says the same thing. But how many books of the Bible are there? 66. So how many chapters are there in Isaiah? 66. There you go. So it's a pretty easy way to remember. So you come to the end, which would be chapter... Okay, so you come to the end of chapter 60. And what a great verse when you look at chapter 66, verse 10. Be joyful with Jerusalem, rejoice for her, all of you who love her. Be exceedingly glad with her, all you who mourn over her. You know, things are going to go well. And the declaration of verse 22, for just as the new heavens, the new earth, which I make, will endure before me, declares the Lord, so your offspring in your name. I mean, what a great hope that is. Now, you know, when in the book of Jeremiah begins to talk about the very beginning, you know, he's calling Jeremiah. Of course, Jeremiah says, you know, you got the wrong guy. And he's scared because he knows that he's going to have resistance. And God says, I'm going to make you strong. I'm going to make you strong. You're going to make it through this. And he has to go through a lot. In fact, to such a degree that Jeremiah goes, okay, you deceived me. I didn't think it was going to be this. I mean, I knew it was going to be hard, but I didn't think it was going to be this hard. And yet, as we come to the end of the book of Jeremiah, we realize that God has made him so strong that he wants to stay with the people, even though he has an opportunity to leave. And you begin to realize that with each of the prophets, God is making them into the person like himself. And there is a kind of metamorphosis that takes place with the prophets. So if you come to the end of the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 52, it's interesting the way this ends, because it ends with them going into exile. And you go, well, that doesn't sound too good. Yeah, but look at the way it ends. It's 52, verse 31. Now, it came about in the 37th year of the exile, Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 25th of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, the first year of his reign, showed favor to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. And he spoke kindly to him and set a throne above the thrones of the kings who were in all of Babylon. So Jehoiakim changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of the life. What a nice way to end. And all the way through, and especially with the minor prophets, of course, Ezekiel ends with, you know, here's Ezekiel is in the captivity with the people of God, like Daniel is. And he can't see everything that's going on in Judah. Of course, much of the book of Ezekiel is horrible things are going on in Judah, and in particular in the temple. And the angel actually picks Ezekiel up and he says, let me show you. And so you have this almost ghost-like picture of Ezekiel being taken through space. And he flies him into the temple and he goes, look what's going on. And he sees things that are going on, sort of like the Christmas Carol. and you come to the end of the book, and the end of the book is the promise that Israel's going to come back. It looks dead, but the bones are going to take life. They're going to come back to life. And the book ends with building the eternal temple. And that's the way the book ends. So once again, with great hope. If you look with me, obviously with the book of Daniel in chapter 12, the end is to God's people. And he says, basically, at the last days, you all who have followed me are going to be like stars in heaven. And I'm going to use you in a great way. And that's the great promise at the end of the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12. Hosea, if you've ever read the book of Hosea, begins to talk about the infidelity of the nation and how they have abandoned God. And you just hear, you know, once again, some very horrific things that the nation has done. And yet at the end, you see the promise of God. And if you look with me in chapter 14, verse 8, O Ephraim, what more have I to do with idols? It is I who answers and look after you. I'm like a luxuriant cypress. From me comes your fruit. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know. For the ways of the Lord are right. The righteous will walk in them. Transgressors will stumble in them. The beginning of chapter 14 at the end of Hosea is, Return, O Israel, and the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. And he says in verse 4, I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely. My anger will cease. In every single case, look at the end of Joel. Joel is full of prophecy like, you know, you guys are going to really get it. I mean, it's full of prophecy like that. But it ends with, and it'll come about in that day that the mountains will drip sweet wine, the hills will flow with milk, all the brooks of Judah will flow with water, the spring will go from the house of God, and you know, God has given them promises of great things. Chapter 3 of Joel, for behold the days in verse 1, at that time when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, and I gather the nations, and I'm going to bring them down to Jehoshaphat, and I'm going to make a decision for my people, is basically the declaration. Amos is going to be the same thing. It'll come to the end. And, you know, all the way through the book of Amos, you know, God's saying, you're not listening to common sense, but here it is. The days are coming when I'm going to bless you so much. The way that he describes it in Amos chapter 9, verse 13, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman will overtake the reaper, the treader of grapes who sows the seed, the mountains will drip with sweet wine, all the hills will be dissolved. Also, I'll restore the captivity of my people Israel, and they'll rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. I mean, every single one of these, you know, except for the specifics that are dealing with other nations, like Nahum or Obadiah dealing with the Edomites, always ends with, in that day, I'm going to change everything, and there's going to be a restoration. The reason I bring this out is that you know, the very beginning of the book of Zephaniah is pretty curt when you think about it. I mean, he starts off and he goes, everything has to go. We're going to destroy everything. We're just going to destroy everything. And the initial response oftentimes to these prophetic books is, well, people just come out like God is really mean. And what it's displaying is that really intense things have to happen in order for wickedness to cease. And you would hope that, you know, you would hope that the graciousness of people would actually change the lives of, you know, this horrific world that we're in. But it's not going to do that. And Isaiah 26 is pretty clear about that. What's also interesting is that you have the dynamic in the midst of all of this evil that we have in the world that pretty much has made up their mind that they're not going to stop doing it. Even if you ask them pretty please, they're going to keep doing it. So in the midst of all this, you have people that have somehow found themselves moving into the same current. Not willingly, but by virtue of the masses of humanity moving in that direction, they find themselves taken into the bad current. And they find themselves doing things that they shouldn't be doing, and after a while, maybe even taking on some of the characteristics of the world. And then you find people that are fundamentally righteous, but they're at a place where they can't do anything, and beyond that point, they also have what we're going to call hidden sins. Obviously, we're just none righteous, no, not one. And so, you know, in the thought of going through difficulty, the thoughts oftentimes are, well, the innocent, you know, gets stepped on. And Scripture's full of examples where God is saying, no, I'll take care of the innocent. Now, we know that the evil and the wicked abuse and mistreat and do all kinds of horrific things. We understand that. That's true. But we also know that our God's righteous and in the midst of this, and that God is working good in the lives of his people. So what makes this book very interesting is, as the name Zephaniah means, whom the Lord hides. And we actually see within the passage that God basically makes a promise to the humble that he's going to hide them. In fact, I just want you to mark it again. If you look in chapter 2 of Zephaniah and look at verse 3, as you come to the end of that verse, seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger. Mm-hmm. So we realize that God is doing a work. Now, the question is, in all of this, you know, major upheaval that's really prophesied in this particular book, what is God accomplishing? And the answer is not easily seen at the beginning, but is clearly identified at the end. And what he's conveying is that he is bringing out and purifying and purging his remnant. And so all of this is done to bring out his remnant, to prepare them for the kingdom of heaven. So in a way, I guess you could say that his remnant are those that you would perceive to be the victims in all of this, the victims of this wicked current that comes in. They're the victims of the fads and the things that the world brings in that kind of draws them in, that maybe have been victimized even to think wrong. But worse than that, they've been victimized in the sense of people just mistreating them. And so in the realm of God judging all these people, there's a feeling that there's going to be collateral damage. And I don't know if you've ever read 2 Peter in chapter 2. But 2 Peter chapter 2 is very clear. There's no collateral damage with God. So like he can destroy a whole world and save 8 people. See? And he can destroy 2 cities and save out a family. So he has no problem doing that. So he can judge a whole world and at the same time, simultaneously, save the righteous. He can do that. And I know that our thoughts oftentimes were, well, how could he do that? I wasn't even there. But he does without us. So What you're going to see in the book of Zephaniah is God doing a purging and a purifying, and then an ultimate gathering at the end, which brings his people back in the state that they should be thinking. Now, once again, righteous people do righteous things, and, you know, to sit back and look at them, they didn't do anything wrong. But God knows the heart. And God is using all these things to draw those who are his into his kingdom. And there's a working that takes place. Now, the fundamental principle that God uses evil to do this is really seen throughout Scripture. And I can give you a thousand examples, but let me just give you a few. You have Abraham. And Abraham is, he's a good guy. He wants to do what God wants him to do, right? There's no problem. So God throws out a famine. Now you have to ask yourself, where does the famine come from? Okay, so that would have to be God that did the famine. But the famine in of itself seems to be an evil thing. Evil, if I were to define evil in this sense, would be calamity, hardship, pain, suffering. So famine is not an enjoyable pleasure thing. And why would he do that? Well, Abraham, I trust you, God. And well, let's see. So famine comes, and where does he go? To Egypt. He goes to Egypt. Now, God is infuriated. No, he's not infuriated. But he's using the difficulty to reveal to Abraham just where his faith is. So he'll go down to Egypt, and of course he trusts in God now that everything's okay. No. He tries to pass his wife off as his sister. And so God begins to use that, and he takes the Pharaoh, and he kind of whispers gently in Pharaoh's ear, you know, your history if you touch this lady. And the Pharaoh goes, shame on you, Abraham. Now, God used the Pharaoh to shake his finger at Abraham. Think about that. A wicked guy, didn't respect God, but he uses the Pharaoh to do that. Who would God use in the life of Jacob to keep him from being a conniving, lying, little cheat? Laban, right. I mean, what better person to do it than your father-in-law? So, I mean, you think of the way that God begins to use these different ones in our life, and you say, well, Jacob was just, you know, was being used by Laban. Yes, but what had Jacob been doing? Now, God had called him for a purpose, and it's very clear that God had his hand on him. But God was going to use these different things. And, you know, our thoughts are, you know, Joseph, just the best kid ever. There's nothing wrong with Joseph. He deserves the best. We're going to give him the best. And quite frankly, he's my favorite. I mean, he'll even squeal on his brothers, which, I mean, what a great kid. You know, hey, Dad, they're not out there. All right, so God says he's a good kid, but he's got to be trained. So where do you train him? Well, good grief, in prison, really? And you have him being sold by his own brothers? Really? Do you think you're being a little bit harsh on this guy? Does God ever leave this? Does God ever leave him? Does God ever forsake him? But he's training him. And in many respects, we would say, well, God's training the innocent. That's exactly what he's doing. You read in the book of Isaiah, and one of the passages I give you, Isaiah chapter 33, and just to clarify the point, you can see God pronouncing disaster upon the destroyer. But if you read verse 1, you'll see that God is controlling the destroyer. So Isaiah 33 verse 1 reads this way. Woe to you, O destroyer, while you were not destroyed, and he who is treacherous while others did not deal treacherously with him. As soon as you shall finish. Now who decides when he's finished? God does. As soon as you shall finish destroying, then you shall be destroyed. And as soon as you shall cease dealing treacherously, others shall deal treacherously with you. What is God saying? That he actually controls the destroyer. So if there's destruction going on, who's in charge of that? So God is using these things. You have the example of Job. If you'll turn to the book of Job in the first chapter. And I know many of us know some of these stories really well, so I don't want to go too much into explanation, but I've oftentimes thought it was very interesting the way all this begins. And I don't know if you remember exactly how it begins, but there are some nuances that I'd like for you to look at. It starts off, you have this guy in the land of Oz, which, you know, we're off to see the wizard, I guess. But you have this guy, and he really is a righteous guy. I mean, he's so righteous that he even thinks his kids are singing, he's offering a sacrifice to God just in case. You know, one of those just in case moments, you know? So God, I know my kids are perfect, but just in case they're not today, I'm going to offer, you know, some sacrifices. And so the guy is a righteous. Look, he's more righteous than anybody in the face of the earth. He's more righteous. Now, in the text, you have this dialogue between God and Satan, which is very interesting to me. And people have often asked, well, why can Satan, you know, come before God? And I can tell you, that's a no-brainer. Because Satan is an attorney. He's a lawyer. He's a prosecuting attorney. Now, a prosecuting attorney has every right to prosecute the guilty. So Satan has every right to prosecute if you're guilty. He can do that because you deserve it. I deserve it. And we know that the angels were over the law. So what is Satan doing? He's going to prosecute. You know, he thinks he may have a case here. Now, what's interesting is that Satan doesn't bring up Job. Did you notice that? God did. God baited him. See, people aren't thinking that way. Oh, why did Satan went to accuse Job? No, he didn't. God pulled Satan in. And he goes, so you've been going all over the earth. And he goes, yeah. Did you see Job? Now, why would you bring him up? Why bring the guy up? I mean, he's the most righteous guy in the face of the earth. Don't mess with him. Why do you think he does that? Because Job thinks his righteousness is going to get him in heaven. And God can't let that happen. So he tells. The same thing is true with, you know, I mean, Peter is thinking he's got it all made. You go into Luke chapter 22 and he goes, Satan's asked permission. I've granted it to him. Because Peter, you've got to be shown that you don't have these things in control. Your life's not right. God uses these forces in the lives of his people to bring out things that otherwise they wouldn't have recognized, to bring out things that would have hindered their lives for the rest of their lives, and to rob them of blessing. God's going to do fundamentally three things in the process of bringing in these forces in our lives. He's going to purge us. He's going to humble us. And I know, you know, I'm too perfect. I don't need humbling. All right, so obviously we do. So to purge us, to humble us, and to stimulate a sense of desire, a longing. You know how you get so good that you get lackadaisical in your goodness? And you know how after a while everything just becomes kind of mechanical? So that's what begins to happen. And it's interesting the way it's described here in the book of Zephaniah, if you look there with me, is, let's see, how does God describe his people? Well, if you look with me in, verse 9, I'm punished in the day of the Lord, those who leap in the temple and the threshold. I mean, you see a kind of defiant, untouchable arrogance in their life. But if you look specifically in verse 12, it'll come about that time that I will search Jerusalem with lamps, and I will, why lamps? To reveal, right? Things are hidden. And I will punish the men, watch the phrase, who were what?
Stagnant
in spirit. I mean, we already know that they're doing things on their housetop. I mean, yes, they're going to church, but then when they go home, they're doing things, you know, they shouldn't be doing. So God says, you know, you've allowed the world to infiltrate your life, and this is what's happened. You become lax, lackadaisical, apathetic, lethargic about everything. I mean, you go through the motions, and, you know, we're all saying, but we're basically good people. And God says, I don't want good people, I want holy people. I want you to be on fire for me. It's like you walk up to a person that you are married to, and you say, I basically love you. Thank you. So there is a wonderful stirring that God is doing in all of this. And he shakes our world. By virtue of what? Well, by virtue of, first of all, the horrific people that surround us. I mean, don't be shocked if you're somehow touched in a bad way by evil forces surrounding you. Don't be shocked about that. I mean, Jesus even tells his disciples that, okay, they're gonna deliver you up. You're going to be accused of things that you didn't do. Well, I never, you know. And that's horrible. Why would God allow that to happen? You know what I have found? God's purging me. He's humbling me. You know, you can't help but think about David. And we were talking about this. You know, one of the reasons why we love David so much is he's so much like us. You know. Except when David really makes a big mistake, he makes it bigger than us. And in some way, I guess we take comfort about that. But when you look at David and you think of the people that surrounded him, more specifically, you think of the people that became thorns in his side. They are much like the Philistines, the Moabites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, that are listed in Zephaniah that surround us. And once again, Philistines, you think of, you know, somebody that's really forceful and oppressive. Do you have anybody that's forceful and oppressive in your life? Well, okay, those are Philistines. And in probably David's case, it could be giants and it could be Joab, his own general, who goes and kills people that he didn't tell him to kill. But he just loves killing people, you know. You just get the feeling, you know, Joab rings somebody with a sword, and it just makes him feel good all under, you know. It just does. But you have people like that in your life that it's almost like they don't have any conscience about it, you know. That's just who they are. And why would God allow a Joab to exist in the life? Why would God allow a Shammai, or actually probably better pronounced Shimei, to curse him when his own son had taken over his kingdom, and it seemed like much of his kingdom had deserted him, even though many gathered around him at this time? But he's pushed out of his kingdom. He literally gives the kingdom over to his son Absalom, and there's another one. Why does God even give him an Absalom? But you have this Shimei, and he just curses and throws rocks. And what does David say? Leave him alone. God, perhaps God has sent him. David understood at that juncture that God was using Shimei to humble him. He knew that. And, you know, oftentimes these things happen to us and we just, we go into our victim mode and we go, why would God let me be a victim? And God says, I'm not. I'm purging you. I'm humbling you. I'm stimulating desire. And you can't help but feel that much of these difficult things that we go through create, they have in me, that create a greater resolve. I'm not going to do that. And I'm not going to let somebody else do that to somebody else. You know, and you begin to draw lines. But more than that, you get intense about things that you used to be lackadaisical about. You know, oftentimes people go, well, why is Pastor so upset? You know, they just did something against God. Yeah, you just did something against God, you know. But the world doesn't see it as a big issue. You know? Yeah, I just offended God a little bit. I'm going, okay, wow. You don't understand. But you almost have to go through something to have that stimulated in you. And so the trials, I mean, David has a wife, Michal, his wife, that, you know, makes fun of him. Doesn't really love him. He has a king that he wants to care about him, but he doesn't, and he hates him, and he wants him dead. What was God doing? Well, everybody that David wanted to love him never loved him back. And God was saying, why don't you come to me? What do you think God's doing in your life? Why do you think he surrounds you sometimes with people that don't seem to be caring or loving? And so you go to him. See, he's stimulating that relationship between you and him. So that you can say, I mean, you read most of those Psalms, and what does he basically say? I said in my alarm, all men are liars. But not you, God. See, David's starting to get it. And God's beginning to transform him and change him. And he's going to make this guy who is known for his passion, but he's going to make him passionate about God, rather than passionate about pleasing Saul or passionate about pleasing his wife or any of those things. Passionate about being liked by people or, you know, being able to control things. So as you look at these things, you begin to realize that God is doing that in the book of Zephaniah. And as we've looked specifically at the list, and once again, you see in chapter 2, the Philistines, the Moabites, and the Ninevites. Moabites being that interesting picture of slanderers, hecklers. Let's see, what do we call them? Ever since vaudeville, what do we call them? Peanut gallery. That's what we call them, peanut gallery. Now, where that phrase actually came from is that the cheap seats was called, where they ate peanuts, was called the peanut gallery. And these were the people that would mock and criticize because they had the cheap seats. So they felt like in order to make themselves look important, because they felt like they'd been pushed back, they began to throw out insults. So it actually began to take on the meaning of somebody that would throw out insignificant criticism in order to embarrass those that are on stage, and they were fundamentally hecklers. So they were people that couldn't do anything themselves, didn't have any ability themselves, but hey, you know, I could become important by criticizing somebody. And so they might criticize the fact that his wig's on a little crooked or something like that. So that's where we get the thing, peanut gallery. So, Moabites, peanut gallery, slanderers, people that criticize, instead of doing the right thing, they criticize the people that are. And instead of doing anything constructive, they're consistently tearing down. Their thought is that they become more important by doing that, but you're going to have people like that in your life. Don't think that you're going to be exempt from that. But it changes your resolve. And God begins to reveal in your own heart. If you've ever been slandered, if you've ever been wrongly accused, if you've ever had people heckle you, if you've ever had, I mean, I could go down the list. If you've ever been the brunt of that, you can get mad. You can try to get even. Or you can turn it in the hands of God and go, I'll trust you to do the right thing. And God, quite frankly, you've revealed to me just how I really don't trust you because of how quickly I got mad about that. And God begins to reveal things in your own life that you didn't even know were there. This is why the psalmist says in Psalm 19, acquit me of hidden faults. See? There are things, and by the time you come to, what is it, Psalm 139, if you go there in the passage, I mean, you guys know how this begins, right? Does anybody know you better than God? No. Nobody knows you better than God. And how wonderful. Where can I go from your spirit? You form my inward parts. We love that passage, don't we? You know what I bet most people don't remember? Is God, kill everybody. It's actually basically in here. Kill them all. Don't let them get away with this, God. You know those mean people? Get them! Which, hey... You know, good. We're all for that, right? Well, maybe. But what are your motives? I mean, you're probably right. They probably do need to get killed. But what are your motives? The passage reads this way. I mean, after he's already said, you know everything about me. How wonderful you are towards me. I mean, all your thoughts about me. I mean, we can't even number them. But then he turns and he says in verse 19, oh, that thou wouldst slay the wicked, O God. For they speak against you. Your enemies take your name in vain. Oh, man, I hate them. I hate them. And you should. You should. But how quickly, when you stay on that, you become hateful. You were right. But watch the passage. Verse 22. I hate them with the utmost hatred. See that? Does it sound like it's increasing? It is. Verse 23. Search me. Nobody knows me like you. Know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. It just may be a hurtful way in me. This may be something wrong in me. You know, God takes those hateful, mean, slanderous, ugly natured people and he uses them to purify you. You ought to thank God. But we don't. But in Zephaniah, what he's basically saying is I've been using these. And then what I did was, I don't know if you watched it, is I destroyed those that were doing it. But I had been using them all along in your life. But he then turns and he says, but you also had family members, i.e. people in Jerusalem, in Judah, in Israel. You also had family members that were that way. And I was using them too. I mean, here again, does God not use Michal in David's life? Does he not use Joab, who is his sister's son? You see these people that are part of the family. And look, David couldn't get rid of them. They were part of his family. It's even his own son, Absalom. He can't get rid of him. It's my son. I can't kill him. He probably should have, but he couldn't do that. But God was using him in his life. So you come to this Zephaniah, and God goes, well, that's what I'm doing. And so I'm going to bring everybody together, and I'm going to pull out. I'm going to bring all the nations, and I'm going to pull out those that, through the process of the sifting, through the process of the mayhem seemingly and the destruction, I'm going to have what I call a remnant. You know, sort of like you're panning for gold, and if you've ever been to those places where you're looking for gems, and they have this these screens, and you just keep shaking, and all of a sudden, you know, hey, there's something there, you know. I don't know what they are, but they, you know, so they identify it. But you begin to realize that through all that sifting, a few, not a lot, and that's what God calls, well, according to Peter, the precious stones that he's been looking for. So if you look with me in Zephaniah, he says in chapter 3, the day is coming, in verse 11, in that day you will feel no shame because of all your deeds. Now, here again, it's a very interesting point that he's been purging even what we consider to be the humble. And he says, in that day you will feel no shame because of all your deeds which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst, watch verse 11, what will he pull out? The proud, yeah. And you will never be haughty again on my mountain. Now that's interesting. He's going to pull out the proud, but then he turns to them and says, and you won't be proud anymore. What he's showing is that pride had taken on, it's sort of like you have hateful people in your life. And so how do you fight back? You get hateful towards them. See? So that's the catch. Your thought is that, well, I'm going to show them. And you find yourself, I'm just as hateful as they are. But if you can let it go, see, if you can drop it. Remember, forgiveness means letting it go. It doesn't mean you can't absolve somebody of their sin. You can't say, you're forgiven of your sins. Only God can do that. But you can let it go. And you can put it in the hands of God to do the right thing and trust him to do it. And you can even rejoice in every single trial and tribulation that he brings into your life, knowing that it's a testing of faith and a strengthening, and God loses not one will he lose. We know that, right? So I'm going to leave among you, verse 12, a what? A humble and lowly people, and they will take refuge in the name of the Lord. The remnant of Israel will do no wrong. They'll tell no lies, nor will any deceitful tongue be found in their mouths. How do you think they got there? There's nobody that is perfect in this. How do you think they got to the point of they will tell no lies? How could there be that kind of purging? See, and you almost have to be like with Jacob. You almost have to be the brunt of deception to hate deception. You have to go through those kind of things, and so verse 14, you know, shout for joy. This wonderful thing, God has cleared the way, and unless you think that, you know, this remnant was at the very beginning very perfect people, he says in verse 15, the Lord has taken away his judgments against you. Why has he done that? Because now they've been purged. And now he can take the enemies out too. If you look at verse 15, he has cleared away your enemies. Why did he leave them in? They were necessary. Just like with Peter, that was necessary for you to have Satan sift you even to the point of you being afraid of a little girl. So how embarrassing must that have been? I'm not afraid of nothing. We'll see. And what an interesting picture of a rooster, you know, it's a rooster. I'm the king of a hill. You're a stupid bird. Nobody, a fox wants to come up and just grab you, you're out of there, you know. But he's crowing like he's king of the mountain type thing. But it's a great picture, and God's reminding him of that. But in that day, it'll be said in Jerusalem, do not be afraid, verse 16, O Zion. Do not let your hands fall limp. The Lord your God is in your midst. He's victorious in your midst. So verse 18 is the final verse that I want us to look at tonight. So I'm going to gather those. Watch the phrase here. How do we know who the remnant is? And here's the key. The remnant grieve when wrong is done. The remnant are not perfect, but they're broken, they're sorrowful, they grieve over sin. That's a huge difference for most people. Oh, really? It's not that bad, really, do you think? Start rationalizing, start blaming other people, start criticizing somebody else, taking the limelight off. No, no. The righteous, I feel so bad about that. Or maybe around the Lord's Supper, it would sound something like this. Was it me? Is it me, Lord? Not one of those other guys was thinking, it's Judas. They were thinking, it could be me. And that's the heart that God's looking for. The heart that's grieving. If you look at James chapter 4, you see that as well. Turn there to James. And you could just feel James going, your problem isn't your hardship. Your problem isn't the pain. Your problem isn't, as he goes into chapter 5, the fact that they're withholding your pay and abusing you. That's not your problem. Your problem is that you haven't wept over your sin. Because once you're right with God, if you'll humble yourself, he'll exalt you. But the problem is, see, we want to exalt ourselves. So James chapter 4, look, verse 6, he gives greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil. He will flee from you. What do you think the devil's saying? The devil's saying, blame somebody else. Don't let them shame you. Don't let them make you feel bad about it. I can just hear him, can't you? God's the problem, not you. Submit to God, resist the devil. He will flee from you. Draw near to God, he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. You know, a passage with chapter 37 of Psalm, and you kind of reverse that, 73, you begin to realize that the psalmist goes, I can't believe it, but I think I actually am jealous of the wicked because they seem to get away with stuff and they seem to have no problems. And here I am, I'm having to do all this suffering. And God goes, are you listening to yourself? You really want to be like them? Be miserable. Watch in verse 9. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Who's the remnant? Well, according to this passage, I will gather those who grieve about the appointed feast. That's who I'll gather. They really feel bad about it. There's a strange, almost bizarre passage in Ezekiel. Of course, Ezekiel by itself is pretty bizarre when you read the book. But Ezekiel chapter 9, if you look there with me, God's going around and he's The best way to describe it is he turns to angelic beings and he goes, okay, here's the deal. I don't think he says here's the deal, but that's kind of a English way to translate the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. But he turns to him and he goes, this is what I want you to do. I want you to wipe out every sinner in the temple. Just wipe them all out. Now, you can imagine he's got these angels. I mean, probably, you know, he's got to hold them back. Because they're guardians of righteousness. So he's holding them back. And they're going, yes. You know, sort of like holding back a pit bull and you finally let him go. So they start going. And they start wiping out. And he says, oh yeah, one other thing. I want you to mark the ones that are righteous. Okay, so it reads this way in Ezekiel chapter 9. Verse 3, we'll pick up. The glory of the Lord of Israel went up from the cherub on which he had been in the threshold of the temple, and he called to the man clothed in linen, whose loins was the writing case. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are being committed. See, we sigh and groan over the fact that we might get caught. We sigh and groan over the fact that we had to pay something for doing something wrong. But who groans over the fact that somebody did something against God? See, that's a game changer there. But to the others, he was saying in my hearing, go through the city after them, strike. Do not let your eye have pity. Do not spare them. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, women. Do not touch any man on whom there is the mark, and you shall start from my sanctuary. So they started with the elders who were before the temple. And he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. And they went out and they struck down the people of the city. And it came about as they were striking that I alone was left. And I fell on my face and I cried, saying, O Lord God, art thou destroying the whole remnant of Israel? Well, it turns out that this was a picture of things to come and God was warning. How would you feel if you were Ezekiel? You know, it's one thing to wish ill on somebody else. It's another thing to watch somebody get slain. And you should have told them. This passage is saying that God is going to preserve those who care enough about what is right to actually feel misery when evil is happening. God's going to gather those who grieve about the appointed feast. And he says, they came from you, Zion. These are Zion. He's actually identifying. You are my people. The ones who care for these people. And, you know, you just realize that you have to go through the difficulties in order for these things to become clear. Let me give you an example. Psalm 136, and I know I'm running out of time, but if you look with me in Psalm 136, you'll see this fundamental point, I guess I could put it that way. I'm sorry, Psalm 137. If you look at the very beginning of this, it's about the children of Israel in captivity. And their feelings about being in captivity is clear within the passage. At this juncture, they don't want to be there. Now, what's interesting is that they were taken into captivity because they had been pursuing and following after the ways of the world. So the very people that at one time they wanted to emulate. We know Hezekiah even invited the king of Babylon to come and look at all of his stuff because he wanted to impress him. You know, and it's interesting how we want to impress the world. But these are the people that are going to take advantage of you. But sometimes God lets the hand play out. Fine, go to Babylon. So, Okay, but I was expecting they would welcome me. Okay, so you misunderstood Babylon. Because Babylon wants to use you, and they want to extrapolate your money and call it their own. So everything you have, they want to take. So here they are, finally by the rivers of Babylon, and there we sit, and what are they doing? What are they doing? They're weeping. Now what's interesting is that there were some that, like when Assyria came in, they started getting assimilating into it. And Babylon came in, the Medes and the Persians, and after a while, there were a lot of people they started to get comfortable with, and they kind of liked it because they felt at home with the world. And there are a lot of people that feel very much at home in the world. They like the world. But there are those that are the remnant that feel oppressed and weep over the fact that the world has rejected God. Oh, everything may be outwardly okay, but we long for God to be elevated. They begin to weep as we sat down and we remembered what? Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. There our captors demanded a song, and our tormentors said, why don't you sing one of those songs for us? But how can we sing? God is not elevated. How can you? But I can tell you this, Psalm 127, I'll close with this chapter. I can tell you this, that when they do go home, that, or 126, I'm sorry, Psalm 126, when they do go home, if you look in verse 1, the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion, see the passage? It was like a dream. Why? Because Jerusalem was the most beautiful place in the world? No, Babylon was. They had hanging gardens. That's where God was elevated. You know, a number of years ago, Connie and I were in California, and we'd gone up to San Francisco. What a beautiful area that is. It's just the drive, the cliffs, and we had actually come from Sequoia National Forest, too, and going through that, just some of the most breathtaking scenery that you've ever seen. We came into the city, and I could hardly wait to leave. I mean, I would have much rather been in my little office on Barrett Road in the back of my house in the corner reading the Bible and being with people that I loved. You get this interesting picture. Our mouth was full of laughter, our tongue joyful shouting. They said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams of the south. Those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. What are you sowing in tears? God, I'm really sorry that your name was hurt. You start crying over the right things, and you'll start rejoicing forevermore. There will be a healing. What is God doing through all of this? Well, obviously, he's bringing out his remnant, his holy ones. And we have to go through these things. We have to go through these things. Father, I give you thanks for your word, just for the encouragement that you give us, that even in the worst of times, you have not abandoned us. No, you're changing us. And you're actually changing us into your image. We could never be the loser in that. And we know that when this is all over, what a day of rejoicing that will be. We give thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.